Good morning, everybody. I mean, I actually can't understand how Almery could have put me with such insignificant people this morning as the first.
Yeah, we're also embarrassed.
As my first panel. In fact, I decided to dress up for them, so I'm wearing my Toyota Yaris silver shoes, especially for the warriors we have here. Ladies and gentlemen, we actually are sitting at an extraordinary time in South African history, and we've only just sort of emerged from it, and sitting with me on the stage are two warriors who've come through an extraordinary time of extricating the country from, or not, we're not out of it yet, but fighting extraordinarily strong forces of state capture, corruption, and general greed and evil. And I really do think they deserve a massive round of applause.
Before you go on, she played an enormous role in it too, so she's being unnecessarily modest.
No, that's just... It's just my job. I couldn't do it without them. So the Kumbaya feast is over. I think what's important when we have this discussion around the inner capacity and the mental and spiritual and emotional capacity to fight back something begins with a personal discussion. So we're going to start. I know they don't like it very much because they're legal people. Personal doesn't really work very well for them, but we'll just do it briefly because I think there's certain set things that get put into place when you're able to hold onto an ethical core and sense and not be afraid. I want to then speak a little bit about the legal ethical issues in South Africa, South African law, constitutional law, the systems that have survived because several of them have been severely broken and were held up by people like Linus and Thuli. And then perhaps I think we'll close off the conversation about speaking about the future of South Africa, what we need. I wish you could have eavesdropped on this casual conversation between the two of them because it's been phenomenal already. So I'm so sorry that you didn't get to hear that, but maybe I'll extricate it from them earlier on. The interesting thing about both of you is that you grew up at the same time, more or less, in South Africa. Both of you, your parents, your father didn't want you to do what you did, which is interesting. And your parents also kind of like, well, you know, as a girl, what is, you know, really, what can you do? So I understand that terrain because I also was born in the same time as all of you. So the world didn't really...
Thanks.
The world at that time... Would you like a coffee, Advocate, pardon, seller? No. Well, Glynis, you're going to drink them all. Both of you, can you, in a sense, speak about the first moment of understanding that your place in the world as a woman, first of all, because we were made aware that we were women, you particularly, Advocate, by your father?
Well, my father was very supportive of me being the best I can be in society. He only had a limited view of what we could aspire for. And it was probably a mixture of patriarchy and apartheid. This was the time when the most educated people we knew, in the township were nurses, clerks, and maybe policemen a bit. My father had never been to school, and he thought, yes, we should go to school, but study long enough to be able to get instructions from the white community. And in my case, by his standards, I was now well-educated. So it wasn't really gender, because he also discouraged my brother from continuing with his education, and he left at grade 10, and I was also asked to leave at grade 10.
So was that because he felt that it was impossible, in a sense, to overcome the structural inequalities that existed and you should just accept that and carry on? Or what do you think led to that? Because when you wanted to be a lawyer, he wasn't necessarily supportive of that.
No, well, with my father, we never got to the fight about being a lawyer. It was my mother who thought I shouldn't be a lawyer.
That's right.
And she was the one who encouraged me to be educated because she had an opportunity to be educated. but she chose to go to domestic work because she wanted good clothes, and the missionaries were not giving her any good clothes. She wanted all of us to be educated, but the influence of my church, I was raised as a Seventh-day Adventist, was that Christians should take professions that would allow them to be upright citizens. And my pastor came to my house having heard that I wanted to study law and asked me not to study law because lawyers were crooks.
Oh. Is the pastor still alive today? And have you been back to have tea with him?
I haven't had tea with him, but he's still alive. But I would love to have tea with him because, again, it came from a parochial view of what is a lawyer. We wouldn't know that, you know, talented prosecutors such as our colleague Dennis here are lawyers, judges are lawyers, public protectors are lawyers. But our limited view of the lawyer was the guy in the corner shops somewhere next to the train station who is mostly approached by people we know have definitely killed someone.
Yeah. Glynis, you're growing up in Kimberley and then wanting to be a lawyer, and your parents sort of hands-offish in a way, raising you. You preferred dogs, you thought people were scumbags.
Still
does. She lies. It's nonsense. And that, you know, our worst nature gets the better of us. And that so your worldview growing up in apartheid South Africa as well, in Kimberley, with these parents, what is it? What is driving you? What is making you rebel? Because you're both rebels, actually.
Not sure that I'm a rebel. I do tend to get into a lot of trouble, though.
No, she's not a rebel.
My parents weren't necessarily hands-offish. My father wanted a son, and he was very disappointed with a daughter. My mother wanted a ballerina, and she got me. So that didn't work out too well. All I wanted to do was ride horses, which is what I did. I think probably they were the most astonished, apart from myself, that I in fact studied law, finished it, and made it a career. I don't think either of them thought that that I was capable of having a career. And I often also thought I wasn't.
I merely mention this because if you have younger children like I do, you start seeing how people form their worldviews. And it's often those of us who are the least popular and who feel the most insecure and the most misunderstood, who for some reason rise up later on and become, I think, such key role players. It's very interesting to see that. I mean, a lot of the popular, beautiful people just sort of, not through any fault of their own, but because I think they engage in the world differently. I think the more hardship there is, sometimes the more one gets forged. I wanted to speak a little bit about your involvement in the 1980s. I think we've arrived in South Africa at an Inzaal moment, which is very interesting and we can unpack in some ways. Does the audience understand the difference between the Inzaal and the Exaal movement? Nod, yes, no, yeah, near? Yeah? Well, there was the UDF was formed in the 1980s as an internal movement of 100 or more so activist organizations. Advocate Maroncella became involved politically actively there and was arrested because of that. But it had a particular culture and way of being which in a sense I think was sidelined in the ANC. Both of you voted for the ANC in the early years. It's just
a lot of us did.
What's that?
Not a mistake I'll make again.
We won't ask you who you will vote for, Glynis, because I mean that would be putting you on the spot. But what is interesting, I think, with the current ANC president, Cyril Ramaphosa, and what the ANC is that it appears as if there's a generation of young people in South Africa who survived the internal struggle in South Africa. So the ANC had Nelson Mandela on the island as a monk, becoming a spiritual being, in a sense, and a world statement. It had Oliver Tambo in London becoming the international face of the party, struggling for recognition from the West, which in a sense ignored the ANC, and then going to Russia. So that's playing. Then we had Jacob Zuma and others in the camps in Africa. And that's, I think, where a lot of the arms deal stuff happened, Joe Modise, the President Zuma himself. And then we had the internal movements in South Africa. Can you sort of give us a little bit of an insight into your political involvement, particularly with the UDF, and the principles of the UDF, and which eventually found their way, threaded into the Constitution, which you helped to write at some point later on, as an activist at WITS?
Thank you, Marianne. I started getting involved in the struggle at the age of about 16 or so, or even earlier, just after June 16. How it all started was that my home in Dlamini, Soweto, was pretty close to Regina Mundi, which is a church where everything was happening. And we would all go there when there would be a memorial service of someone and listen to speeches about what was going wrong. My father, on the other hand, it's interesting that you talk about Mandela being a monk in Robben Island, because my earliest recollections about the struggle and what was it all about was information from my father. And there were two things that he always spoke about. He always spoke about how they were forcibly removed from a place called Albertine, where they had free title and to the land, and then they were moved to come to Dlamini. And then he spoke very fondly about Nelson Mandela, who was in Robben Island. Well, at that stage he would say it was Robert Island, because my father had not really been to school, and he wouldn't have read some of those things. Regarding my involvement more meaningfully, it was then mostly in the 80s, when there was the formation of the South African Youth Congress, the UDF, and I was also involved in the founding of COSATU. Incidentally, the current president was in the negotiating team for the founding of COSATU. He was on the other side. There were two camps of unions when we started. I was part of the UDF 7, negotiating for the National Union of Printers and Allied Workers. And was pretty much involved until the late stages of the formation of COSATU, but had to go back to university because I was working for the trade union movement during the holidays. That also introduced me to the struggle in a broader way, because once I was involved in the struggle, one day we happened to visit Mama Albertina Sisulu, and what a fantastic human being. This year is her centenary, and she's one of those really unsung heroes. A person of integrity, a person of great compassion, and an inclusive leader in terms of race, gender, and other forms of difference. And I spent a lot of time going to her house during holidays and just listening to her and discussing with her. And later, of course, she became a former leader of the UDF. What else do you want to know?
I think what's interesting there is that set platform, I think, for a particular view of the non-racial South Africa, a South Africa that I think later came to sort of shift somewhere else under President Jacob Zuma's rule for different reasons. But I think it's important to remember there are many people like yourself who remained in the ANC and in South Africa who weren't quite sure as the state capture began. Yes. That is where it was headed, but we'll get to that point. Glynis, your own views, you become a prosecutor and you start prosecuting in Pretoria, but mostly commercial crimes, I mean, that which in a sense are not always just commercial, they're political as well in a sense. Your experience of South Africa becoming a prosecutor in the old sort of system and then moving into the new South Africa.
I started prosecuting in Johannesburg. And I was lucky, it was towards sort of the end of prosecuting what would fall under apartheid legislation crimes. So crimes under the Righteous Assembly Act, past law offences, that type
quite
of thing.
Quite crude law.
Very crude law, but I was never exposed to it. Those prosecutions had already mostly phased out by then, and I certainly didn't have to do any of them. I'm not sure what I would have done if I had to do it. And anyway, I was way too junior, so I was prosecuting the small stuff. I prosecuted for a couple of years in ordinary courts, and then I started specializing in commercial crime, which is really quite clean. It's always just about money, and it's somebody else's money at that, so it doesn't really matter. Yes, there were political overtones in commercial crime because it became very clear that, building up to 1994, there were certainly offences that you could term white collar crimes that showed that the kind of fraud, corruption, particularly corruption, and what people now term tender fraud. Certainly happened pre-1994.
That's what I was.
And we prosecuted for it then too. The difference was it was a lot more subtle, considerably harder to find and investigate, but also in its execution more subtle. After 1994, it sort of became a free for all, and it increased quite dramatically, and became a lot less subtle. So, for instance, pre 1994, out of a tender of 100 rand, you would find that somebody had stolen 20. Post 1994, as time went by, it just increased. So, eventually, we were at a point where in a tender of 100 rand, a couple of people had stolen everything. And that was the marked difference.
Then also the marked difference becomes the adoption of the Constitution and mm-hmm. a very sophisticated system of law in South Africa, coming from this crude base of laws aimed at oppressing people, dispossessing people, controlling their movement. We get this beautiful, extraordinarily complex Constitution, which you helped to draft as well. Both of you then find yourselves, interestingly enough, there are characters in your lives who intersect later on in the prosecuting sure. authority, including the president himself, the former president. Weird to say it.
Lovely to
former,
say it.
Former president Zuma. Just let that really roll out of your mouth.
Ex-president
Zuma. There was a time when we never thought Nelson Mandela would be released. You when you were in it, you thought it's not possible. It couldn't. And there's been a time in the last 20 years where many of us have thought, we're not going to be able to say former President Zuma. Now we're saying it. It's quite something. Something to be proud of. Then we look at the Constitution and where we arrive. And this is where I want to perhaps speak about the law a little bit, because you believe people are intrinsically unethical. I think leaders bring out the best and the worst in us. And the law is something clinical and sterile. And you can sort out right from wrong with the law. It's
Absolutely.
A very clear system. Perhaps your view of the law is slightly different to that, or what are your feelings around this living organism, this thing we had to marry with a battered, bruised, broken society, and together with customary law and various other laws that exist around human behavior? Do you believe people are intrinsically corrupt?
No, I don't believe people are intrinsically corrupt. I think we're all born pure. Think of a beautiful little baby and think how loving all of them are and how pure they are in terms of their outlook in life. But we all, of course, socialized by various agents about what's right and what's wrong and ultimately what's important and what's not. A lot of people who are corrupt are not necessarily people who are brought up to believe that stealing is fine. I have noticed that it starts with need to greed, particularly my experience as a perpetrator, and probably, Glenys, you might have found that when you delve deeper into how it all started. My role as a perpetrator brought me to spaces where I found that there were two kinds of people that ended up being involved in corrupt deals. One would be need. One of the basic needs is just the need to keep your job. A lot of whistleblowers ended up losing their jobs. I know of a woman in Limpopo, for example, who was eventually fired for pretty much something similar to using too much toilet paper, although it wasn't really using too much toilet paper, but she was fired for not being able to produce a box of applications for a secretary position, which box of applications was for her own PA, which had happened about 3 years ago. But what was the real deal? It was that they'd asked her to sign on a tender, on a contract. There was a contract for somebody who was going to provide consulting services. At that stage, the price was 5 million rand. And then the DG writes back, or HOD writes back to her and say, please increase the amount to 10 million. She writes back and says there isn't enough work for 10 million. The HOD writes back and says, find the extra work. And she writes back and says, I can't find it. And then eventually she then gets asked for those CVs for PAs and she can't find that and she gets fired. And another one, in the case that involves MEC, former MEC Mike Mabuyakulu, the lady comes to the Treasury Department. She finds Treasury is running air shows, which shouldn't be run by your CFO in an ordinary organization, finds that they funded a jazz festival that never happened, a couple of millions involved. All of these things involve millions. And they're asking her to sign more things that would involve millions, and she doesn't think Treasury should be doing these things and doesn't think anybody should be doing them to start with. And in no time, she gets into trouble with her colleagues, her subordinates, who are fairly senior people and they've been in the system forever. And they tell her that if she doesn't want to play ball, they're going to get the MEC to deal with her. And within a few days, the MEC sends her a letter asking, or the HOD sends her a letter of asking her why she shouldn't be suspended. But what's the suspension? Nothing to do with refusing to do unlawful things. The suspension is you being too hierarchical and rude.
So people start finding beginning to use the system against people doing their jobs. But you found that in the NPA. Once the NPA had become caught up, initially you thought, oh, this is great, it's outside of the Department of Justice, we can prosecute, we can do this. But then you begin to, it dawns on you, oh my God, that this system is being captured for a particular political motive. And people become more and more afraid of speaking out and doing their jobs. I mean, that's so interesting that it's unspoken, unsaid, and it's about need to keep your job. I think we need to speak about how can we not speak out when we see something wrong. So tell us a bit about the dawning realization that the NPA itself is being captured by President Zuma in particular after the charges and the stage gets set for him to become the president of the country.
Well, it didn't only start under ex-President Zuma. And at the outset, let me say that I hold the view that if you have to lie and cheat to keep your job, it's not a job worth keeping. It started off, and I'm not suggesting for one moment that there wasn't political interference in the prosecuting services prior to the NPA. I just wasn't aware of it, personally. But certainly I'm not suggesting that there wasn't any. I'm quite sure there was. And other people who were there before then have said that there was. Again, more subtle. Certainly after the advent of the National Prosecuting Authority, there were a couple of things that were concerning. So Tuli will know that during the negotiations for the new constitution, there was a sticking point about a national director and whether there should be one, and if there was one, should it be a political appointment? And that was a big issue. And at the end, it was a compromise. We all, and when I say we all, the people within the justice system felt that there shouldn't be one. And we referred to it then as the super AG, the super attorney general. So prior to that, attorneys general had been the top structure of the justice system. It worked very well because they all held the same rank. They were peers in terms of ability, experience, etc. And they kept each other in check. If one did something that was a little bit odd, the others would have been on him immediately. And I say him because there were no women. There was a very distinct glass ceiling in the justice service, and it was right down there. With the advent of the national director, and then it was a compromise to make it a political appointment. And we all knew that trouble was coming. I mean, it was a matter of trouble. It's inevitable. But exactly what the trouble would be and how much trouble it would be, that we had no idea. But everybody was concerned. And almost immediately there was, again, very subtle pushing the envelope politically in the NPA. But it was never overt, it was very subtle. And it wasn't
be a phone call, sort of
do you think you could maybe do this? You said no, then it was fine. It was left at that. I said no many times. Give this a warning instead of no. and nothing further happened. So, but the, you know, it was there. It was always there. But the big thing that bothered us, and it still bothers me, and it's something that we should change, is that Lady Justice, prior to the NPA, so the Department of Justice, Lady Justice, is the lady with the scales. Everybody knows it. And she doesn't have a blindfold. She does have a blindfold. She doesn't see.
Yes.
She has a blindfold.
Yes.
She doesn't see. She sees nothing. She sees no color, no creed, no sex, no religion. Everybody's the same to her. The NPA's Lady Justice doesn't have a blindfold. They took it off.
Is that true?
That's
the logo. It doesn't have a blindfold.
They took it off. And we all knew shit was coming.
You've got to look for the signs.
Yeah, because if Lady Justice can see who she's dealing with, that's the problem.
Wow.
And that always bothered us, and it still bothers me today.
But it also comes, I mean, the arms deal, I mean, we know where we come from, apartheid South Africa. People often justify current corruption by saying it was there in the past, which is, none of us buy that. It's not an argument that is sustainable or to justify anything. But as an activist and as a lawyer and as a constitutionalist, when one began to realize the extent of the arms deal, in fact, we had a president who came in with those dropped charges and who's now leaving with them, bookended, in a sense. So it was always going to be a struggle, but did either of you have a sense of just how huge the struggle would become? That it wouldn't just be then about saving one man from his day in court, but it would become an entire project called state capture. And, let's hold that thought there, in a global sense too, because it's happened with Putin, it's happened in the United States. It's a global problem. State capture is a global issue politically, I think in a post-ideological age, perhaps.
Well, certainly, state capture is something the people of California rebelled against many, many centuries ago, and that's why they asked for the sunshine laws, where most things are done in the open, and hopefully some of the provinces will follow the Gauteng province in terms of making sure that advertisements are open, but also the selection and appointment process in the tender system is equally open. But let's go back to apartheid, corruption, and present corruption. There's a book that has been written by Henny van Vuren. There is a link between what happened in the past. There's an American First Nations saying that if you don't fix the hem of your dress, you'll soon be without a dress. What happened in the system is that there was corruption, and corruption soon became a cover-up. Let's just take with the first BEE scheme. The first BEE scheme was promoted under the Treasury. But what has always bothered that Moiletsi Mbeki is why select politicians to be partners in business schemes. And then that model was followed, that BEE was primarily about bringing people with political clout into the scheme to share. So I think we have to be a little bit more deep dive into the roots of corruption. But I would agree with Glenys that it has gone out of hand, and I like what you mentioned about it used to be 10 to 20%, which is something I learned in Nigeria, that it used in Europe it's still 10%
right.
Or so. And and in Nigeria, when I went there in 2010 for my first outing as a power protector, they told this joke about an African minister who went to the East and found his colleague rich and asked, why are you rich given the fact that we're not paid much as ministers and public representatives? And that other fellow said, you see that road, 10%. And 2 years later, he comes to visit the minister in Africa, and the minister in Africa is not rich. He's living in opulence. It's a castle, and he has a showroom for a car garage. And us, you said you were paid even less than us. How is it that you seem now to be far richer than me? And then he says, you see that hospital? And he looks and say, where? He say, you see that hospital? He looks, where? And you know the answer. I laughed though, like you did. This was the beginning of 2010. And never in my life did I think that anybody could be that terrible to steal everything and leave nothing for the poor. Until I did some of those investigations, a guy who was paid for building 400 millions worth of RDP housing, only built one, the showroom, but was paid the whole 4 million. The one who built pipes to nowhere in the Free State, where he was paid to end the bucket system. He was paid, but the bucket system was still there when we went there. Why was the bucket system still there? It was because he built the toilets, which is cheaper to build the rooms, the toilet seats and et cetera. And then, but no piping system and no sewage system, and hence the report was piped to nowhere.
Yes.
Glynis, a bit like the toilets at Nkandla.
Oh, they also piped to nowhere. But Glynis, your sense also, what is amazing, though, you know, is I want to sort of quote Marx to the two of you, not Karl Marx, Groucho Marx. Groucho Marx always used to say, who are you going to believe, me or your eyes? Which I like very much, because if you have a community who understands, and there's some in the Eastern, they're everywhere, you've been the Gogotlaminis. If you have a community who is, at the moment, when I was at a SCOPA hearing 2 days ago, where CETA, the State Information Technology Agency, said that in December it didn't have money to pay salaries because of a corrupt deal that SAPS, which is a criminal syndicate on some levels, had done with Mr. Keith Keating, a sole supplier, for over 17 years. So, you know, eventually what starts happening is the employees of CETA begin to see, oh my God, this is affecting me. I'm not getting paid. Eskom, you know, Optimum Mine. But what is extraordinary about the Gupta leaks and the Guptas themselves and the family and how they arrived in South Africa is when you look at those emails that the Daily Maverick happened to obtain legally, we legally obtained those emails, you see how deep the system is, that it almost feels like there was another brain behind it. They had people in Home Affairs, they had people in the Free State, they had people in provincial, municipal positions, they had people everywhere who were willing to do the bidding, and you know, it's quite astounding. It's almost as if people fell into a trance. While the two of you then begin to look at the sort of the legal aspects of it and see, my God, this is actually a raid. It's treasonous. It's a treasonous raid on the country by people who claim to represent us. It's almost so horrifying. You immediately, I mean, the minute you started exposing it, they started targeting you, and you too. You know, you were both targeted by a very, I think, powerful cabal of people. And it's quite scary when we sit here now and look what we've come out of, actually. And that Chapter 9, and also you are our gift from President Zuma.
One of the
good gifts that kept on giving right until the end. I love that sort of relationship that happened there. You were speaking earlier on about ethics, and how do we change this need and greed into service? Because I know the UDF, and I know there are many people in the DA as well, where the issue of service and serving the public, serving fellow human beings, particularly, I think what's interesting is one expected the white minority racist government to only look after one group of people and to abuse everyone else. It's kind of ethically, that's what they were about. But you almost are horrified that people who themselves have been at the receiving end of abuse and horrendous for years on end would do the same. What is the mindset of the ANC? What is the mindset of the deployees of the ruling party?
I think what's the mindset of our communities, South Africans? And I think we have lost a little bit of our own morality. We're living in a world of instant success. Corporate world has also been a little bit part of it.
A little bit. I mean, they enabled it.
Exactly. But it all boils down to that emphasis on the appearance of success as opposed to real success, because real success might take longer to achieve. I spoke about need when you really are going to lose your job. In this case, I chose two women who chose not to play ball, and they lost their jobs. They went to us. We fought, and they went back into the system, and many others. But there's also another need. Eskom, where a lot of the people that you're talking about that eventually became part of that syndicate are people who had no jobs at the time the syndicate found them and deployed them. Or they had jobs that were not paying them well, and they were battling to pay their bills, they're battling to live the lifestyle they thought they deserved, and the syndicate got them. So it starts with wanting to solve one little problem, and then you are in the syndicate and you go through. What then can we do? I think we need more transparency in the way appointments are made. Firstly, we need to entrain the values that are in the Constitution. Honorable Breitenbach, we discussed a little bit earlier about the need for training in ethics. But for me, the sense of it is that we have foundational values in the Constitution. Those foundational values are not always built into the codes of conduct that people are going to sign. But also, there's no point in getting an MP to sign a code of conduct or to get a minister to swear to the oath of office if you found them already corrupt. Because if Section 195 says people who are employed by government should be people who operate with the highest level of professional ethics, they're not going to operate with the highest level of professional ethics simply because they've signed the code of conduct. You should make sure that when you recruit people who are already operating with the highest level of professional ethics. And then secondly, then train them properly. But lastly, hold them accountable when they do wrong,
well, that's
with
what I
no
to say.
Impunity for anyone.
So, Lewis, as well, we've lost our ethical compass,
yes,
certainly, but we have not lost our legal compass, because it was the law, ultimately, that saved us, or that is in the process of saving us. We survived intact in the Chapter 9 institutions to a certain extent. So, Parliament failed us, the legs of government. Executive failed us, Parliament failed us, and what was left was, Chapter 9s didn't fail us, you didn't fail us, but what was left was the law, where you had decided to go. I mean, tell us a bit about your struggle in the NPA. And you've just, congratulations, they've just dropped the charges against you.
No, they didn't drop them.
They didn't drop them.
I was acquitted.
You were acquitted.
It's a
big
difference.
Huge difference. Huge difference.
The difference is about 2 years and $10 million.
Yeah, well, that's a hell of a difference. But I mean, yeah. Also, you know, not to underestimate the threat of violence to people as well. Actual physical threat of violence. There was a threat on your life, and I'm sure on your life too.
Several
threats. I mean, so the threats go from, you know, abusing the law and trying, as the president has done for how many years? Eight, nine, 10 years process, to actual physical threats, because these people have a lot to lose. And when I sit here now and I think about what has been accomplished, it's quite extraordinary that the bank accounts are frozen. People are off. I mean, I was driving in the car the other day and I got my niece aangedraai to where the Guptas are fugitives. And it felt like a fiction. I was like, hey, they're fugitives from justice, the Guptas. How's that? So, you know, it's like, whoa, never thought it was going to happen. The first family
should bother
left.
You.
It should bother me.
It shouldn't make you happy. It should bother you.
Oh, well, look, it'll bother me later. Can I be happy just for
the
a moment?
The reason that it should bother you is, under Zuma, they did nothing.
Yes.
The criminal justice system failed to function because he made it so. Under Ramaphosa, they're all of a sudden functioning because he made it so. They're supposed to be independent.
Yes.
They shouldn't act on the whim of anybody. It's fine now because they're
Absolutely.
Going after the people
Absolutely.
That you want them to go
yeah.
after. Mm. But tomorrow they may go after people you don't want them to go after. And then what are you going to do?
Yeah.
They need to be independent. They shouldn't act on the whim of a politician.
How do we assure that? Because I think what you said earlier is, I think, honestly, that South Africans have been so abused for so long around ethics and morality that I see in young people no longer know what is right and what is wrong.
No, that can't be
true. There were people sitting at SAPS at the SCOPA hearing who didn't understand senior management. What is wrong with a supplier paying for a trip of two cops in the supply chain management thing to go to? They said the trip was official, but it's, you know, the supply chain, the supplier paid for the tickets to something. It was like, what's the problem? It's, I think, you know, President Zuma has the same issue. Like, what's wrong with me asking a whole lot of people to?
I don't accept that for a moment. Every single person sitting in this room and everywhere else in South Africa knows the difference between right and wrong. We all know it. Whether you choose to ignore it or not, that's a different issue. But everybody knows when you're crossing a line. I don't believe for one moment that anybody doesn't. Lots of people don't care. They seem to have the ability to shrug it off and do whatever. And the rest of us schmucks can't.
Yeah, but I think the schmucks are the... I mean, if you look at President Donald Trump at the moment and what's happening in the United States in terms of systems and institutions that might not survive him intact, and we'll talk about how we survived intact. I think life is an ongoing struggle between the schmucks of good people and the really bad people. It just seems to be an ongoing project, which is also something you believe in, that democracy and the Constitution and freedom is not something that arrived one day. And as a journalist in the middle of this, because I was there in the 1980s, I thought, ah, Mandela's out, cool, it's going to, you know. And we were naive to believe that that was, I mean, I don't know why we were.
No, the good acts always win.
Yeah. Say that again?
The good acts always win.
The good acts always win.
Yeah. May take time, may be difficult, but the good acts always win.
But that's exactly, I never for one moment did I think the day would not come for the Guptas and others who are implicated in state capture to be brought to book. I mean, on my Twitter timeline, I always would say that, you know, the sun will come tomorrow, because it was going to come. The question was, we always know that lies are more agile than the truth. But the truth eventually does arrive, and justice wins all the time.
Absolutely.
It's an extremely comforting thing to hear you say, because for a very long time, and, you know, there was a feeling that the struggle is so huge. I mean, there were assassination squads roaming around KwaZulu-Natal, you know, both of them, I mean, Glynda says she doesn't do fear, she doesn't do anxiety, she doesn't do those things. I don't believe that, because the actual pressure, when you are at the forefront of this fight, these women are warriors, absolute warriors. And the notion that truth will triumph is extraordinary, because we've seen it in this country several times, over and over again. But it doesn't mean we should relax. What do we do now? Both of you earlier on said, the systems have survived intact. You've survived intact, acquitted.
There you go.
You've survived. You gifted us the state of capture report before you left office.
Yes. Well, I would say what we need to know is the reason we are on the pedestal of hope again is because women, men, and children outside government eventually became part of the deal. The opposition in parliament also pumped up its actions. In other words, to strengthen constitutional democracy, we don't just need Chapter 9 institutions and the courts. We need all of the elements of our strong democracy to work. And throughout the troubled times, these institutions were all working. But I would think of all of the institutions, the one institution that wasn't working well was the people. I think the people had subcontracted democracy to politicians, to courts, and to the media. And when things really, really, really went badly, and when the rand started to really hit us, and when Minister Nene was fired so randomly, and it really hit all of us, people awoke and realized that this can't happen. This time we shouldn't wait until things go wrong. And Glynis is right that even the most benevolent of leaders are going to have propensities for human failings. And whether the Ramaphosa presidency goes to the light or to the darkness will depend on what role is being played by the people.
And the law.
Does President Ramaphosa get to fear the dark side of the ANC, or does he get to fear the light side of the people, the opposition, and the law? And that means that we'll have to keep that fight going, that fight for goodness, that fight for justice. And ultimately, it's a fight for peace, because as long as there's injustice, and corruption is an injustice, because it undermines social justice and other forms of justice, as long as there's injustice, there can't be sustainable peace anywhere. The White Monopoly Capital campaign last year, or for the last few months, nearly broke down this country. And I still believe that there's damage that needs to be repaired. But why it caught fire was because a lot of the work around social justice had not been done. So my invitation to people is we need to do three things. play our role in promoting integrity within the state and within society, and play our role in promoting social justice. And lastly, play our role in building capacity within the state. And that's your point earlier about training on ethics, but also training on good administration, public administration, yeah. Which is the law side, because some of the wrongs came because people didn't know some of the rules on public administration.
Very simple rules. Very simple rules.
Certainly.
Bruce, Parliament, the role of Parliament in this new Ramaphosa, Ramaphosa. We have Ace Magashule there. We have people there who've been accommodated for now. Batabili Dlamini.
What do you mean for now? They're there.
Yeah.
It's not guaranteed that it's for now. Ace Magashule is infamous for corruption. I mean, he is Mr. Corruption. Gigaba is still in the cabinet. Batabili Dlamini truly must be the most useless human being on the face of the earth. She's in the cabinet. And they're there. So it just shows that Cyril is just a lick of paint. He doesn't have control of his own organization. He has no power in the National Executive Committee. Clearly, he didn't get the cabinet he wanted. He looked like a deflated soccer ball when he made the announcement. And I would be too if I'd had Gigaba and Batabili Dlamini and Mokonyana in my cabinet.
The Department of Women.
No. I mean, have you ever a Department of Women? She's just destroyed single-handedly the entire social grant system that mostly are women, dependent upon it. And she's now in the Department of Women. Well, good luck to her. I'm sure he's going to phase it out, and that can be the only logical explanation. But, you know, you're very kind when you say Chapter 9 institutions, and they did play a huge role. Parliament failed us miserably, but the opposition parties, I think, played a great role. The judiciary were magnificent and continue to be so.
Absolutely.
We've got the best constitution in the world, and that's thanks to people like yourself. But you'd have, and the citizens of South Africa were like Trojans. They were magnificent. They stood up and took back their own country. But you leave out the press, the investigative journalists like yourself. Scorpio, Emma Bungani, and the investigative journalists in this country should all get the enormous crux. It's them that place this thing where we are. You.
Thank you very much. I just want to say one thing about that I could not do what I did, or we could not do what we did, without whistleblowers, people whose lives were placed at risk in government, good people, wonderful people, some in the ANC, many in the DA, some in the EFF. And while this struggle was happening, a lot of people would say to me, but how come you're not depressed? How come you... I mean, I could sleep at night because I knew that there were people fighting. And I learned really, truly, for the first time, what the meaning of the word comrade is, the true meaning of the word, where you look after other people. And I just wanted to ask for the audience here, because the project ahead requires solidarity, requires human solidarity,
certainly,
requires a cross-class solidarity, and requires us to actually get out of our comfort zones. Other than the marching, what can we... I think we're a white middle-class audience here, unless I need my glasses. How do these lovely people who've come to hear you, who are celebrating and carry, all of us carry the burden of our history, how do they make a difference, from both of you warriors? Give them some inspiration in terms of what they should do.
She's going to be kinder than me, so she can go first.
Well, firstly is to thank the people of South Africa and the world for reclaiming South Africa, as you've just said, Marianne. And I must also congratulate the investigative journalists for stepping in and really uncovering the last piece of state capture, which has now led to the change that puts us at the dawn of democracy. What do our people do? The first thing I would say we need to do is never again should we find ourselves on the verge of despair again. Never again should we allow things to degenerate to the point where we're really at the door of the winter of despair, as we were last year. But, and also, never again should we allow politicians to divide and rule us on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, on the basis of class, as a dead cat to divert us from wrongdoing including state capture, corruption, and all other forms. But how are we going to be able to avoid the divisions? One of the things we ask you to do as Stellenbosch University, as the law school at law faculty at Stellenbosch University, is let's all join hands to advance social justice. Because of the continuing divisions of the past, primarily around inequality and poverty, it was easy to introduce the white monopoly campaign and get some people, some even physically going to defend the Gupta compound because they were getting some pay from the process. But there was also resonance with the fact that some people are poor. I always say that when a member of your family has been killed, often people don't care who goes to jail. You probably have seen that. They just want somebody to go to jail. But people exploited poverty, and through political entrepreneurship, they used the cry for social justice as a way, as a buffer against the fight to end corruption and state capture. So you come in and prevent social justice being used against us. And secondly, I then also said that as an ordinary person, you are the eyes and ears of the state. And the state is not the governing party. The state is broader. You are the eyes and ears. And get involved in social accountability. And what is social accountability is whatever you see, you find a way to end it if you can end it. If there's nothing you can do to end it, report it. That's social accountability. Somebody says they've built a bridge and there's none, you have eyes and ears, and you can tell that the bridge wasn't built. And lastly, if you're in business or in any place where you have some skills, transfer those skills to as little as preschools right up to the CEOs and functionaries and parastatals, local government and broader government.
Glynis, what are your...
I'm not a politician. I'm never going to be a very good one, but I'm going to sound like one now. The Democratic Alliance believes in freedom, fairness, and opportunity. So do I. It's coincidental that we both believe in the same thing. And Julie's quite right. The big issue here is social injustice. South Africa is the most unequal society in the world. And as long as we allow that to remain, we will always be vulnerable to this kind of thing happening. So the haves must give up something to uplift the have-nots. You've got to get out of your comfort zone. You've got to do something for other people. You've got to give up a little to get a lot. And as long as we can't do that, South Africa is not going to work. We have to get to a point where all South Africans have the same shot at prosperity that we have. And that's the only way we're going to make this country work. And we can all do that. It's the easiest thing in the world. We can all do that. Something we can do.
I think it's an important thing also because I think when someone asks you for something, even in the street, you must give. We live in a place where a person who begs for money at a traffic light doesn't choose to do so. And you might be annoyed by it because there's so many people, there's so much need, there's so much poverty. It's really hard for people. If you have, as much as it annoys you, as much as you think you shouldn't be doing it, as much as you think your tax is being spent somewhere else, give. Because the pain is enormous and the abuse is enormous. And if we have a little bit and you can give some more, then please do. I just wanted to end up with reading this, you know, Glynis's bit in the rule of law. I don't know if there's time for questions afterwards. You've got this. If we do that, there's no other country in the world like South Africa. If we do that, if we care, we're unbeatable. I love to see South Africa in 200 years' time, and I'll never leave. Never. I'm not here because I have nowhere else to go. I'm here because there is nowhere else I want to be. And I think that it is very beautiful, and I think that that sentiment works for me because of the two of you and your courage and your bravery and your honesty and your... No, I know, but it's not been easy. It's not been easy. And thank you for what you've done for the country. Thank you so much. I'm sure there's no time for questions. There's no time. I've hogged it all. Thank you very much to both of you for coming. Thank you, Almarie, for inviting us. There's so much more we can do and say. Please just support these two magnificent human
Thanks,
beings
Marianne.
Here we're going. Thank
I
you.
I just want to say exit is that side, and the two authors there is a table where they're going to sign books.
Please get
No
books.
Longer Whispering to Power. Tully's biography would be on sale there, Rule of Law, Glynis. And you can ask a question or two to the authors.
Please, and they are so great. Worth it. They are so, so worth it. Please get their books. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.